Welcome to the second quarter Weatherby podcast. We are glad to have you guys back who were able to join us in Q1. And we are excited today because we have, we think, some awesome information for you related to deprescribing in hospice. And we certainly have an expert on hand to do that. With me today is Greg Dyke. He is a registered pharmacist specializing in hospice and palliative care pharmacy practice. During his career, a long storied career, he has started two hospice pharmacies, worked for or consulted for numerous hospices, and served for many years as vice president of pharmacy and new business development for a 300-plus ADC hospice in the Chicagoland area. While there, he was responsible for medication use practices. He also ran the nurse practitioner-based palliative care practice, as well as conceived and built from concept through service delivery their entire hospice inpatient unit. For the last 10 years, he has served as president of clinical consulting for a national hospice pharmacy PBM. He has also served as an adjunct assistant professor, to two colleges of pharmacy and served as the pharmacy advisor to the NHPCO regulatory and relatedness committees. Greg is currently a quality and compliance representative for Harbor Light Hospice, which is a large multi-state hospice provider, and he is also an independent hospice pharmacy consultant. He has a BS in pharmacy from the University of Illinois College of Pharmacy and has practiced end-of-life care pharmacy since 1985. So like I said, I think we have an expert on hand to talk about this particular topic today. Welcome, Greg, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Melanie. I'm happy to be here today.
Great, great. Well, let's just start from the top. Greg and I have had the opportunity over the past couple of weeks to talk about this topic, and it's fascinating to me. And something that, when I started in hospice 23 years ago, I didn't know we'd be talking about stuff like this, but we are. Everything's evolved so much. But Greg, let's just start at the top. Just tell me, what is deprescribing?
So Melanie, the best way to look at this primarily is from the patient and kind of hospice's perspective. And in reality, what it is, it's a systematic process whereby we identify and taper or discontinue medications when the harm of its use outweighs its benefit. And I think what's important to remember is that the harms are actual as well as potential. It's important to understand that these activities and actions be performed within the specific context of an individual. In other words, this is not an organization-based, one-size-fits-all approach, but it's really at the patient level. What we want to do is we want to take into account a patient's values, their goals of care, their preferences for medication use, and their life expectancy.
Right.
One other thing to think about is that, along from the patient perspective, there's also a system perspective. And probably the best way to put that is that deprescribing is an essential part of good prescribing.
That makes total sense. One thing that you said that I love, which is one thing that I love about hospice, is that there's no one size fits all. And a person that is in a hospice program, plan of care drives everything. And so this falls right into that. But just kind of overall, tell me why deprescribing is important.
Well, I think what we need to do is we need to absolutely be sure that we're aligning medication use to patient goals. And there's a little bit of a history to this and some outstanding external factors that I think are important for us to understand. And first, we operate in a healthcare system where drugs play a significant role in managing disease. Americans take a lot of meds. Last year, we took about 5 billion prescriptions. Now, 4 billion of them are from retail pharmacies, and the other billion or so are from in long-term care residency or hospitals, et cetera. And we spend a lot of money on meds. Last year that was, or in 2017, that was more than $450 billion. I think the sad thing here is that, you know, it's arguable, or it's really not arguable, that a significant portion of that spend may not provide the added benefit or improved quality of life that we expect from or for our patients. And secondly, and the way to look at this, or why it's important, is from the clinical perspective. As we age, organ function declines. You know, for example, renal function declines about 20% between the ages of 40 and 65, and about 25 to 40% from ages 40 to 80. In addition to that, hepatic blood flow declines about 10% per decade. And you know, this results in a variable decrease in the liver's ability or capacity to metabolize drugs. This is important because it's the liver and the kidney that metabolize and excrete drugs. The clinical effect of that is that really the more meds that a patient takes, especially as they age, you know, the greater chance we have of drug interactions, adverse effects, or a prescribing cascade. And the prescribing cascade is what happens when we have a side effect of a medication, and rather than discontinuing it or changing it to something else, the prescriber just adds something else. And, you know, of course, all these clinical issues are compounded in patients that have multiple morbidities like heart failure and other life-limiting illnesses. Third, you know, this is really kind of a social issue as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. We're living in this culture where we believe there's a pill for every ill and a mantra or desire of better living through pharmaceutical chemistry. Mm-hmm. You know, much prescribing today is population health and guideline driven. And unfortunately, hospices inherit that artifact prescribing of the systems that prefer them when the patient is admitted. Mm-hmm. Now, adding to that, we have other cultural changes going on. Probably the biggest one right now is this whole movement toward legalizing cannabis. We have natural health initiatives going on, so we have a lot of use of supplements and homeopathic drugs. And when you add all this up, before you know it, the average hospice patient is taking 10 to 15 meds.
Mm. Wow.
So, you know, that's really, I know that was a long answer, but that's really why it's important. We really want to try to get a hold of that.
Sure.
Because at the end of the day, there's really a hole in the prescribing system. Okay. And that is, while there's guidelines to prescribe, there really aren't any, or there are very few guidelines to deprescribe.
That makes perfect sense. So, you know, all of that certainly is important. Tell me why you believe that it's so important to the hospice industry.
I'm laughing because this is the place where I'm going to make people go back into their memories and probably the bad memories of being in math in grammar school. And I say that because what I want you to do is really want you to think about the old concept of Venn diagrams. This is the part of math where you have three circles, mm-hmm. kind of aligned in a pyramid, one on top and two on the bottom, and the circles intersect each other. And the reason that I like using that illustration is because I believe that there are three principal factors that have a direct effect on patient care and hospice operations. The first factor is the regulatory compliance or risk management issue. The second is a clinical appropriateness or patient-focused issue. And the third is a financial management or cost containment issue.
Okay. And, you know, all of those sound really important to me. So in your mind, is there an order to that? Is there a relevance in the order to that?
Funny you should ask. Mm-hmm. You know, just last week, the CMS put out the draft wage and payment index mm-hmm. for hospice.
Right.
And you know, as I think we all experienced, CMS is the 800-pound gorilla in the space.
Yep.
One of the other things I'd like to do when I talk about this topic is I like to use an analogy to illustrate this point. And so, you know, bear with me while I kind of go through this.
Sure, look, sure.
Go through this, but you know, so I want you to think of CMS as a train, and the various analyses and studies that they do are the fuel that gets the train moving. along the track. You know, draft documents and guidance are the steam that we see as a result of the combustion of the fuel that's put into the train. Annual policy changes are the manifestation of the movement of the train, kind of moving down the track, if you will. And that cow catcher at the bottom front of the engine is what happens if we don't get, if we as hospices and practitioners don't get on the CMS track. Because at the end of the day, it's the regulations that really power this train.
Right. So that makes perfect sense, and that's a perfect way to end that analogy, because you listed the regulatory compliance piece first. So tell me a little bit about what you mean by that. Why is that one so important?
Okay, Melanie. Well, you know, as I just said, every year CMS publishes that draft wage index and payment rate update.
Right.
And after they distribute it and after a comment period and review by the public, the CMS publishes the final rule. Sometimes there are changes, sometimes there aren't.
Right.
Over the past few years, CMS has used this mechanism to alert the hospice community of concerns that they have, particularly about resource utilization, trends, usually the ones they don't like to see, costs, potential fraud, lack of compliance with their guidance. You know, CMS, it has not been shy at all about telling us what their expectations are.
Mm-hmm.
That expectation is that virtually all services received by a beneficiary after they elect hospice is elected to the hospice stay.
Right.
And over the past 6 years, this whole notion of Part D costs have been a particular concern. You know, many of us have probably heard of the OIG report,
right,
where they said that hospices potentially could be double dipping. In other words, they're getting reimbursed for meds through the per diem payment, but they're not paying for everything that they should be paying for, and those bills are going to Part D.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, as a result, they kept a really close eye on the spend. And over the years, CMS has become more and more granular when it comes to their analysis and kind of letting us know what their expectations are for medication coverage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, recently, and actually not only recently, but all along, CMS has told us directly that after the election of hospice, their expectation is that many maintenance drugs that are used to cure or treat conditions that may not be related to the terminal prognosis are typically discontinued.
Right.
And in my mind, if that's not an expression of a direct expression, an expectation for hospice to prescribe, I really don't know what is.
Right. That's pretty clear, isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in a new twist to this year's wage index advice, what they're saying is that they're seeing many more anecdotal reports from beneficiaries and caregivers, where hospices aren't covering what they should be covering, and really, kind of as a result, CMS is proposing to modify the hospice election statement, or the content within that statement, and all with the intent of increasing transparency for patients once they elect hospice. In other words, CMS doesn't want to have Part D or Part A or Part B pay for items that they feel should be part of the hospice benefit.
Right.
And they certainly don't want patients and their caregivers or families to be paying the affiliated copays.
The extra, yeah.
And moving forward, what they propose to have a title for this necessity, if you will. And what they want to do is they want to call it patient notification of hospice non-covered items, services, and drugs.
Wow, that's again, a long title.
It is, and if that's not a clear indication of where they're going,
exactly,
you know, nothing is.
Exactly. Okay, so that makes sense. Regulatory compliance first, and then I think that you talked about clinical appropriateness. Tell me why you rate that second.
Well, you know, I think, of course, good clinical care is paramount for hospices. But I think one of the things that we don't always recognize or put at the top of our list when we're doing our various analyses and interventions is that hospice patients really are different than the general population. You know, a hospice patient by definition has a short life expectancy.
Right.
And, you know, looking backwards, you know, the need to actively manage life prolonging treatment really isn't important anymore. So in essence, what we need to do is we need to do this pivot from a population care, illness prevention focus of care to a tertiary or really a symptom management focused treatment plan. And, you know, we're really going, I believe that this is really going to accumulate to the patient's quality of life.
Okay.
You know, another thing on the clinical side to think about is that patients have multiple diseases, and with those multiple diseases, they often have multiple prescribers, and as a result, they have a high number of meds. Med profiles, because of this, med profiles often have significant therapeutic duplication. You know, earlier I mentioned 10 to 15 meds as a common number of meds for a hospice profile. But as a pharmacist practicing as long as I have, I've certainly seen many patients with 20 and even 30 meds, which is not only ridiculous, but it's also problematic at the end of life.
Exactly.
And interestingly, very few hospice patients have 5 or few meds.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important because there's this this notion of, or this word that we use in pharmacy. It's called polypharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the definition of polypharmacy is actually someone taking 5 or more meds at the same time.
Okay.
And so when we get to these profiles of 10, 15, 20 meds, you know, what is that? There isn't even a word for that.
Right. And as their disease progression goes forward, I mean, it's got to be hard for them to take pills and to take the medications.
Absolutely. You know, I'm sure that within the audience for this this podcast, there are probably plenty of nurses who have had patients who have said, geez, I feel like I rattle when I walk.
Right.
Or they'll say, I'm really not very hungry because I spend my whole day taking tablets and swallowing the water that it's required to swallow them.
Right.
It's really very difficult.
Yeah. Even I have heard that over the years and patients saying that, and I'm not clinical, so not being a clinical person, even I have heard that. So you mentioned in these three parts, you mentioned the last thing was the financial management. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Okay, so I certainly look at this from as having two pieces.
Okay.
And the first one is that the general prescription market, so everything that happens on the drug side before a patient gets to hospice has a direct effect on hospice operations.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we hear all sorts of stories about drug price increases and the big PBMs being middlemen and all that. And as I was thinking about this podcast today, I was trying to figure out how drugs increase in price over time. And so I did a quick search of drug price increases. And I have to say, I really wasn't all that surprised to see that drug price inflation is set to run at more than 6% a year until 2016. That's a lot. Maintenance drugs, like those for diabetes, are a very commonly used class of medications today. And I think we've all heard stories of patients on insulin who are spending $500 or more for a month.
Yep.
And why that's important to us is that hospice is like a cash price payer when it comes to branded products. So that's almost cost prohibitive. And on top of that, we've got our new drugs constantly being developed. Some of them are therapeutic advances, and some of them really are kind of combinations of drugs, all in an attempt to extend patent life.
Yeah.
And probably the biggest class of drugs that affects us in hospice are the COPD meds. Mm-hmm. There's always a new inhaler that's coming to the market, and these things aren't cheap.
Right.
They come in 30-day supplies, and a supply will cost the hospice, depending on the drug and strength, between $300 and $500 per prescription.
Yeah.
And so again, we have that significant costs hitting the hospice bottom line, and you can see we've got some financial issues pretty quickly. And secondly, what I mentioned just a few minutes ago was kind of the change in guidance.
Mm-hmm.
This is a large and potentially unknowable hole for hospices. Hospices are like people. They have different practices, they have different desires, they have different guidelines, they have different oversight. In my experience is that the hospices that are most in alignment with CMS's requirements of covering virtually everything are covering about 90% of the meds that a patient is on. Mm-hmm. So if the guidelines change and hospice has to pay for more medications, the total cost of their meds on an organization basis, probably go up maybe 10%.
Right.
But I certainly know hospices that are much tighter when it comes to covering medications. And in those cases, they might be covering only half of what's on a patient's profile.
Mm-hmm.
And so to translate that into numbers that the audience can really kind of get their minds around is, if your current experience is $7 per patient per day for drugs, and you have to pay for 10% more, your cost might go up to about $8 per day.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're paying $7 a day and you have to pay for 50% more, your costs could go up 50% to doubling.
Wow. And that's just not doable in the hospice world. When you look at the metrics that you measure, that's a huge one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But unfortunately for us, with all the data that CMS gathers, they believe that hospices are adequately funded.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, they think that hospices are overfunded.
Mm.
They're saying that there's a $30 per day profit in many cases.
Mm-hmm. And that's definitely not true. You and I know that's not true.
Right. There are probably some somewhere, but, they're certainly not the ones that I work with on a daily basis.
Yes, yeah.
And it's so this is potentially a significant issue for hospices today.
Right. Okay, so to me, just a few more questions that I have. This is kind of where the rubber meets the road for the folks that are listening to us. The rest of the podcast, the first part of the podcast has been very informational, but like I said, this is kind of where they can, our hospices that are listening can take this and really make an impact. Tell me what you think the steps, or what do you think is the approach for hospices to take regarding deprescribing?
Okay, so the first thing I think is education.
Yep.
Deprescribing is an essential part of prescribing, but we really don't look at it that way. So what we should do is we should start teaching that every medication should have an exit plan.
Right.
It's really important for all of us, patients, family, caregivers, clinicians. We need to have a common and shared understanding that as life expectancy gets shorter and goals of care change, that we should be looking at medication use from a different lens. And we should focus on the here and now.
Yep.
What symptom is a patient experiencing today? What medications are being used to manage those symptoms? And that's really the first place to start on the education plan.
Okay.
And then each hospice should have should implement a consistent and continuous deprescribing practice. It starts with the initial and comprehensive assessment when we do the complete medication reconciliation.
Yes.
Ideally, this is done before the formal admission. I perfectly understand that this is often a hard thing to do, but we really need to change in order to what we do in order to make this successful, and education is part of it. We need to do an assessment of current need, including the risk and benefit. We have to have a monitoring plan for what happens if we have a problem with the change of a med. In other words, what are we going to do if the patient has withdrawal symptoms or if their condition worsens a little bit? And we have to have a formal review process. And you know, and what I say is IDT is the perfect place for this.
Right.
You know, while it's potentially going to add a couple of minutes to the IDT, and if we think about what the components of the IDT are, medication review for every patient who's discussed that day should be part of this.
Absolutely.
And by the last thing is, I think there should be a direct question or an action item in each plan of care.
Okay. That makes perfect sense to me, though. So, but how do you do that? I mean, how do you really put feet to this and do that?
You know, that's the $64,000 question, right?
Right.
You know, I think we have to change the culture. I mean, I don't mean that in a negative way. Culture change is hard, and people are busy, but we have to really make this a priority, because it's not only for the patient, although, you know, that should be first. It also accrues to the benefit of the hospice organization itself. Now, I look at admission to hospice as an inflection point in the trajectory of a patient's life, and we are very used to all sorts of changes in our lives when we kind of run up against those inflection points. And I think it's important for us to not look at deprescribing as taking something away or abandoning a patient or giving up on them, but rather as a positive, patient-centered refocus on what's important to the patient and what's necessary. You know, we want to be the change for the patient and their family. So with that, we want to drive the conversations. We want to frame the appropriateness of continued medication use in the most respectful way and in the way that most aligns with the patient's goals. And we really need to start these discussions on deprescribing or medication modification as soon as we possibly can. Because the reality is that if we don't do that at the beginning, it becomes more and more difficult as the stress of, you know, the patient's worsening gathers on everyone that's involved.
Right. Okay. So tell me this. Can you tell me any specific meds, or maybe I should ask for classes of medications that comes to your mind just immediately as some of the ones for end of life care deprescribing?
Sure. And that's, of all the questions, that's probably the easiest one you've asked so
far. Great.
Well, it's easy to answer, but it's a little bit more difficult to implement and have some folks kind of grasp. But you know, maintenance meds are probably number one on the hit list. Yeah. Proton pump inhibitors. And so, you know, medications that are used for reflux are probably among the most overprescribed meds on the planet today. Statins, medications that are used to manage cholesterol, you know, fantastic for long-term cardiovascular benefit, but not really or seldomly appropriate at the end of life.
Okay.
And histamines, medications for dementia, particularly those for patients who are in hospice for dementia and have very, very poor FAST scores.
Right.
Medications for diabetes.
Okay.
You know, as we get closer to the end of life, our appetite changes. You know, as a result, we need less blood sugar modification. We also have to be acutely aware of the fact that a primary cause of emergency room visits for elderly patients today is hypoglycemia.
Mm-hmm.
Other meds are aspirin, meds that are used for primary blood pressure control, vitamins, minerals, supplements, homeopathic meds, medications that are used for bone health like bisphosphonates, and even urinary medications when patients have an indwelling catheter, which of course is common at end of life. Mm-hmm. Adding to that list, you know, there are even meds that we commonly use at the end of life, or end of life symptom management, but which may not have the best of effects. So medications for anxiety or sleep, anticholinergic drugs to dry up secretions, or even non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for arthritic type pain. Of course, each case is individualized, but you know, that's really, those are the nuts and bolts as to as a pharmacist, what I'm looking at and what I'm discussing with a nurse or a prescriber.
Right, right. So, Greg, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, and we're nearing the end of our conversation. So over the last few minutes, you have laid out a wonderful case about deprescribing, and everything sounds awesome. I mean, it sounds like it should, you know, should be what's happening, especially in the hospice industry. But there's always an obstacle. There are always challenges to do that. And probably there are a lot of challenges to implement deprescribing. So real quickly, give me some of the challenges and the barriers that you've seen.
Okay, so first is probably a psychological attachment to a medication. It originally prescribed for some reason. It's preventative. It's for long-term health. And you know, now that we're trying to deprescribe it, you know, patients could have ill feelings about that.
Yeah.
There are physical factors. Clinical complexity or rapidly changing diseases often cause us to not focus on medication modification because it's not viewed as important. You know, finally, the system factors that affect or that are barriers. You know, overlapping prescriber authority and autonomy is a real big deal. I have to say, historically, many physicians and prescribers kind of run in their lanes. You know, they're specialists, and you know, they prescribe for a specific condition, and they're very unwilling to kind of transit into someone else's turf.
Right. That makes sense. So, okay, let me take a pessimistic look at this real quickly and get you to join me there. What if hospices do nothing? What's the result if we don't do anything?
My whole conversation today is a kind of a theme of threes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I looked at there are three things here too. One is sub-regulatory change on the guidance side, on the rulemaking side. If hospices don't fix this, their ability to designate items as unrelated is going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
What that's going to do is it's going to cause the second thing, which is it's going to change the expense side of the hospice budget. Medication costs are going to go up, and as I said previously, I think they're going to go up a lot for many hospices. And then third, you know, this is maybe it's a little bit less certain, but it's something that we should never overlook, and that is recoupment activities from the Part D plans. And I think we have to remember that these insurance companies, this is a business. Part D auditors have the ability to go back 3 years into claims. And if we look from a very simple perspective, we look at what CMS has told us about what the Part D spend was that they were concerned about, you know, that averages almost $400 million a year. So if we go back 3 years, that's over $1 billion. That is, you know, that's not change. That's just laying around on the floor. That's real money to the Part D plans. And I would be very surprised if they didn't go after it.
Okay. That makes sense. it's got to change. I know that it does. You and I have talked about some awesome resources, and I tell you what, we have a list of those resources that if any of our listeners want to just email us, all they have to do is info@weatherbyresources.com, And we will send them an incredible list that Greg has provided us with and get this out to them so they can get more information on that. Again, it's info@weatherbyresources.com. So, Greg, just to wrap up, all of this is so incredibly interesting to me and I'm sure to all of our listeners. And it's necessary. It's not just interesting. It is necessary. Give me a quick three. We're going to end on a three like we've been doing. But give me a quick three of how can hospices, what can they do to get started today?
Sure. So I'm going to say one thing in three parts.
Yeah.
You really want to convene a deprescribing team. So Okay. The three things are you want to decide from your organization who should be involved. Please don't forget your marketing and community outreach folks, because along the line, you're going to want to create some patient and referrer friendly talking points.
Okay.
You're going to want to do some of your own research. So as Melanie said, feel free to contact us if you want a list of where to get some information. And then, of course, I would be remiss if I didn't say contact your pharmacy, your hospice pharmacy benefits manager, and dive right in. They have great tools. They have great reports to help you navigate this. You know, I happen to know of at least one PBM that has a specific deprescribing tool that helps the nurses manage the conversations with patients and prescribers.
Yes.
And that's really, you know, that is... I cannot emphasize how important that is, helping the nurses be comfortable, because, you know, they're the case managers. They're the ones who are having these interactions.
Exactly. Greg, thank you so much. This has been great information, and your expertise, it comes through loud and clear. And so we just appreciate you giving us this time today. And folks, don't forget, we have a great list that we can send straight to you. If you'll just email us at info@weatherbyresources.com. And we look forward to joining us for our third quarter podcast. And when we'll have another great conversation with information that you can truly use. So thank you again, Greg.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you.